Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. I'm Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Public Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest in your area, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on economic meltdown when we come back. The income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. Now, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We covet our neighbor's property, and we call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes. We practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods. We call them governments. And we don't get away with these crimes either. We're now paying up to 75% of everything we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by savings and loan companies. We drive cars that are owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt. Then we owe another $8 trillion in national debt. We are surety for another $49 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Our financial institutions are leveraged out to $60 trillion worldwide. Trillion with a T, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. We live from paycheck to paycheck, and then we're taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and ask for my free 4-hour compactness package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about economic meltdown. What do you think is going to bring it on? Will it be a crash or a turmoil in the derivatives market? Will it be the stock market crash like it was in 1929? Will the money just cease to pass as currency like it did in 1783? Will it come suddenly like it did in Russia and Argentina? Or will it come over a long period of time that'll give us plenty of warning so that we can prepare for it? You know, everybody wants to be prepared for the worst-case scenario. I remember 1999. People were preparing for Y2K. It was a big deal. And then when Y2K failed to materialize, people, I think, were actually disappointed. I wasn't disappointed that the end of the world didn't come in 1999. And, in fact, if the economy didn't collapse, I wouldn't be disappointed if I was prepared for it like most people buy insurance. And most of you listening to me right now have life insurance, and you've been paying life insurance policy premiums for 20 or 30 years. Are you really disappointed that you didn't die? Are you disappointed that you didn't get sick, you didn't get cancer, so that you could cash in on your health insurance? We buy insurance because we want to be prepared for the worst-case scenario that we actually and earnestly hope will never happen. Nobody wants to use their health insurance. Nobody wants to die. And I'm the last guy in the world that wants an economic collapse. It's just that all of the fundamentals are in place. That's the thing that bothers me. When I look at Gibbon's decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and then I look at the American Empire, I say, my God, we're doing all the things that the Romans did just before their collapse. If you take a look at the economic fundamentals today in 2006 and compare them to 1927, 28, and 29, they're all in place, and they exceed all of the numbers that were in place in 1929 before that collapse. And I say to myself, well, my God, you know, we Americans hold the record now for the longest period of time for using fiat currency. Do you know that? Yeah, we Americans are now the new world champions. No civilization, no empire, no nation or group of nations in the history of the world has been able to keep an economic system afloat using fiat currency as long as we Americans have done it. And not only have we done it here, we have exported it around the world. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And so now I look at all of this and I say, well, how long can this go on? In the face of history, which they tell us repeats itself, how long can this go on? Could it go on for another 5 years, 10, 15? I thought that when interest rates in 1979 under Paul Volcker hit 21%, I said, this is it. The game is over. We are going to go through another 1930s-style economic Depression. My God, they pulled the fat out of the fire. And by 1982, the economy was on the upsurge. Through the 80s, we just had a wonderful economy. Just everything was just going great. Of course, we were going further in debt, and everything was ballooning and expanding. But you know, you were eating three squares a day, weren't you? And you were investing money and doing all those things that people do. You know, Sally soccer mom taking the kids to soccer practice, and Joe six-pack enjoying another Friday night in front of the boob tube. And then there was a little burp in 1987, and then there was a recession about 1990, 91. Remember, George Bush, you know, was the heir to the recession. And then as the recession was actually remedying itself, people didn't want to stay the course, and so they voted in Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton presided over 8 years of just nothing but boom times. God, things were just couldn't be better. And that's what paper money does. It gives us boom times. It makes us feel real good. It's like a shot of heroin or cocaine. God, you just feel great. But then ultimately it wears off. And it comes to an end. And then the next shot of drugs, the next shot of cocaine, has to be a little bit bigger than the last shot, because the last shot wasn't, you know, it was good, but your body becomes more tolerant to it. And so you got to have a little bit more in order to get the same kick. It's like smoking. I remember when I was a kid, I started smoking. Hell, I only smoked one or two cigarettes a day. But after a while, I was smoking a pack a day. You got to have more nicotine in order to keep your body saturated with nicotine, keep you satisfied. Alcoholics are like that. Alcoholics can tolerate more and more booze. You know, most normal people, they drink three or four highballs, you know, and they're just about out of the game. I had an old buddy of mine one time, his name was Darwin, and he was a salesman, a great big guy. He was from Canada. He was one of you Canadians. He came down here to the States, and boy, could that guy salt it away. After a sale, you know, at night, you know, we'd go out and eat, and so then we'd hit the bars, and old Darwin could drink 21 highballs between 9 o'clock and closing time. That's 9 o'clock and 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock if you're in California. 21. And then get in the car and drive home. And I've often said I'd rather drive with Darwin drunk than I would with most people sober. I mean, he was good. But he had a body tolerance for booze that just defied description. Not only was he a big man, but also he was an alcoholic. My Uncle Carol was an alcoholic. He was drinking 1 gallon of Gallo red wine a day. A gallon a day. Hell, most of us couldn't drink a gallon of water a day. Well, I'm not here to preach a sermon on alcohol or booze or drugs, but my point is that economics is kind of like booze. You know, when you go into these excesses, the next round takes more and more and more. And the world is now so immersed in the excesses, economic excesses of fiat currencies, that there's no turning back. I mean, we are addicted to good times and easy money. The old adages of the past, you know, work hard and save your money and invest it wisely and things like that, that's no longer the case. Americans are no longer saving, and you can't blame them. I mean, why would you want to save money in the bank? You know, if you put $1,000 in the bank today, and let's say you're getting 5% interest, hell, the inflation rate's over 10%. I mean, you're losing 5% if you got your money being saved in the bank. So people take their money and they run out and they spend it, whether it's on booze or wild women and song or whatever it is, to get rid of it. Which is exactly what happens to fiat currencies over time. They become less and less valuable, and inflation gets higher and higher. And finally, it gets to a point like in 1783 here in America where the continental currency ceased to pass as money. People just wouldn't take it anymore. And so they went on to the Spanish mill dollar, or they went on to something else. And that's the way people are today. Guys like Warren Buffett, they are diversifying out of dollars. In fact, almost all of the news reports that I pick up, everybody is telling you diversify out of dollars. Get into Swiss francs, get into euros, get into yen, anything. But dollars. And then I told you here from the international forecaster that the Zurich bankers are expecting a 50% devaluation, which means that on Friday, when you buy the six-pack to come home, Joe, to watch TV, on Monday morning, the money that you have in the bank is going to be worth one half. And then all of a sudden, prices are just going to skyrocket. It's what you call hyperinflation. And all of the pundits, all of the newsletters, all of the numbers, all the fundamentals are telling you that this is what's coming, except the news media. And except the president, of course, he tells you that the economy is fine and strong and growing and you should buy more stocks. Now, remember I mentioned Kitco? Well, last time I gave you an article here from Paul Van Eden on Ron Paul's address to the Congress. Well, Paul Van Eden is just one of many writers, newsletter writers, who writes for Kitco or is published by Kitco. Now, Kitco is a bullion dealer. Kitco sells gold. They have a motive in life. They want to sell you gold. I'm not here to promote Kitco. I don't care where you buy gold or whether you buy gold or if you even know what it is or where to get it or want anything to do with it. It's not relevant to me. I don't get any kick or commission off of it one way or the other. I recommend it, and I'm pointing out that Kitco, which, by the way, you can go to at www.kitco.com. That's how easy that is. KITCO. And there's probably 10, hell, there might be 20, I don't know, but I receive probably 10 of these newsletters free. Now, come across my desk every week, and I've mentioned the Magombo Guru. I really like Magombo because he's kind of humorous. And he writes a very humorous newsletter on very serious subjects like economics, which most Americans, and indeed I should say probably most people in the world, have no concept or understanding of economics. They don't even know how to save money. They don't know what money is or how to use it. And that's just where reality is. You go to public school, but nobody teaches you about money. Money is not a subject that you learn anything about in public education. And indeed, if they thought that you were learning anything about money, they would brainwash you out of it just as soon as possible. So I like the Kitco people because they do a great public service in publishing people like Paul Van Eden, because it'll give you a little opener here to this world of economics, which is going to impact upon all of us, whether we like it or not. Now, you can hide yourself from it if you want to, but it would seem like to me that rather than hide from World War II, we should be facing up to it. Instead of hiding from World War III, I think we should be facing up to it and preparing for it. It could mean the difference between life and death. Well, economics works like that. You're either prepared for, you either know what's coming, and then you're ready for it, and you take advantage of it, or you're not. In which case, then, you're just like everybody else. You just get surprised like the Argentinians one day. You just wake up and find out your government is bankrupt, your country is on COD, and you're going through an economic crisis that's going to last about 4 or 5 years, and it's probably going to take your house away from you and everything that you've got. It didn't kill everybody, but, you know, it was tough sledding. And I don't like tough sledding, so I'm more inclined to want to take action. It's kind of like people that buy insurance. People that buy insurance don't like tough sledding, so they like to be prepared. For instance, I knew a lady over here, her husband died the other day. He got killed. That's what happened. He had an accident, and he got killed. And they had a lot of mortgages. I mean, they had mortgages on their houses and cars, and everything that they had was just maxed out. Fortunately, this guy, preparing for the future, had mortgage insurance and had all these insurance policies and life insurance policies. And when he got killed, his wife came out smelling like a rose. I mean, everything all of a sudden is bought and paid for. The insurance kicks in and solves all their problems. And they knew that that possibility was there, and that if he got killed and their wage earner was lost, his wife would be up against it. And so they prepared in advance. Gosh, and look how well it turned out. I mean, as bad as it was, it really turned out well for her and the kids. All right, let's see how well life can turn out for us. Paul Van Eden says, and by the way, Paul Van Eden has a website, www.paulvaneden. Now, his last name is E-E-D-E-N. So it's PaulVaneeden.com. PaulVaneeden.com. He says, longtime readers of my commentaries may recall that I have been waiting for the dollar to fall while U.S. interest rates rise at the same time. And even though it may not be intuitive that the dollar could fall while interest rates rise, I think current events in both China and Japan are setting the stage for it to happen. All right, now, what's going on in China and Japan that would cause the exchange value of the dollar to fall? And if the exchange rate of the dollar falls, what's that got to do with you, Joe, Sally, in Poughkeepsie, New York? What do you care? All right, well, listen up. To show how significant recent announcements from both China and Japan are, I'm going to recap the events leading up to them. If the following is too brief, I suggest you read past commentaries on my website, and he refers you to his website at www.paulvaneeden.com for more background. Well, since 1992, more than $4 trillion of foreign capital have been invested in the United States. This capital influx was due to a series of currency crises, beginning with the Brazilian real in 1992. Capital, which is seeking a safe haven, poured into the United States. Initially, this influx of capital caused U.S. interest rates to fall and U.S. corporate profits to rise and consumer spending to increase. The resultant bull market in stocks and bonds was fertile ground for investor speculation, and it gave rise to the high-tech or internet bubble. When the high-tech bubble burst, the Federal Reserve reacted by artificially driving interest rates even lower, causing a real estate bubble in the United States and averting the collapse of the broader U.S. stock market. All right, so we'll pause here for a moment and let's take a look at what we have just read. Because of other foreign currencies becoming weaker and weaker, economic crisis, for instance, in Brazil, Brazilians and other people invested their money. Money flees to a safe haven. So in the 1990s, foreigners invested their money in America because the American dollar was, in their view, a safe haven. And it caused everything in America to go into a bull market. God, things were great, weren't they? And as things got greater and better, we developed bubbles. And when you make a lot of money, you have to have a place to put it, and so people invested it in stocks and bonds. And
Then when that stock and bond market collapsed in early 2000, we lost about $7 trillion of value. I didn't, but you know, if you had money in stocks, you lost $7 trillion or your share thereof in value. So money seeking a safe haven went into real estate. I mean, when you cash out of the stock market, now you've got all this money, what are you going to do with it? Well, it's invested in real estate. This creates another bubble called the real estate bubble, which has now reached its peak in June of 2005 and is now headed down. And one of these days, it'll bottom out. And everybody in the business expects that real estate values will bottom out at around 40 to 50% of their peak values. So if your house was worth $100,000 in June of 2005, you can expect at the bottom of this cycle that your house will be worth about $50,000. You follow that? So if you wanted to sell it, you should have sold it by June of 2005, taken your cash, converted it to gold, put it in a hole in the ground, and then waited for prices to go down 50%, and then come back into the market with your gold, convert it to Fed notes, and then buy two houses. And then you'd have two houses waiting for the next cycle. I mentioned to you in the last broadcast that opportunity is like rain. It's everywhere. And that's just one opportunity. So people like Warren Buffett has cashed out of dollars, and he is now holding silver and gold and other currencies, waiting for this revaluation of the dollar and the economic turmoil that will come from it. Then he will swoop into the market and buy your house for 50 cents on the dollar and all the other houses in the marketplace, like Donald Trump. How do you think these guys make money? It's not buying at the top and selling at the bottom. It's buying at the bottom and then selling at the top. That's the way that game is played. But by the time the average Joe Sixpack realizes that there is investment opportunity, he's buying in at the top. That's why people don't want to buy gold. See, it's already doubled in price. And so they say to themselves, well, my God, gold's already doubled in price. I've already missed that opportunity. Gold has not doubled in price. Let me repeat that. Gold has not doubled in price. The price of gold in 1980 was $800 an ounce. The price of gold today, as I speak, is pushing $600. It hasn't even reached its 1980 peak. And the value of the dollar has declined by 50% since 1980. So today's dollar is only worth 50 cents compared to 1980. So the real price of gold should be $1,600 an ounce, but it's only six. Gold has a long ways to go before it peaks out. Now that's another story for another day, but when we talk about opportunity, I'm sitting here on the sidelines waiting for the collapse of the American economy. Indeed, it's going to be the collapse of the world economy, which is going to affect all of us. Now, it's going to affect all of us in different ways. An old mentor of mine, Russell Harvey, cashed out in 1927, 2 years before the stock market collapsed. Remember, in the 1929 crash, everybody laughed at him and made fun. He sold his Transamerica stock for $273 an ounce or a share, as I recall, and at 273 converted it to gold, hung on to the gold until 1935 cash, because there was a change in gold and cash in 33, but he bought back into the stock market in 1935 at $5 a share, and Transamerica and Bank of Italy had merged, and they came together and formed Bank of America. In 1954, those stocks were selling for $54 a share. So he sold out at 273, bought back in at 5, and I don't know if he sold, but by 1954, they were worth $54 a share, or 55 long in there, and they were paying about 6% dividends. Now take a look at the dividends that you're receiving off of your stocks today and ask yourself, are they really worth having? Are they assets or are they liabilities? If you've got stocks paying 5% interest or 6%, they're liabilities because the purchasing power is going down by 10% a year because your government's inflating the currency. Right, now going on, when the Southeast Asia currency crisis began in 1996 with the fall of the yen, the extraordinary amount of capital that flowed into the United States caused an unprecedented rise in the U.S. dollar exchange rate. This increase in the U.S. dollar exchange rate in turn caused a decrease in the price of all things priced in dollars, such as oil, commodities, metals, gold, and of course, all U.S. imports. Lower import prices in the United States in turn led to an expansion of the U.S. trade deficit. And at the same time, we also saw the emergence of China as an economic powerhouse with a massive shift of manufacturing capacity away from North America and Europe to China. In order to maximize the benefits of the strong U.S. dollar, both China and Japan elected not to sell the trade dollars that they were receiving back into foreign exchange markets. Instead, they bought U.S. treasuries with those dollars. Under normal circumstances, when a country such as Japan receives trade dollars due to its trade surplus with the United States, it sells those dollars in the foreign exchange markets by selling dollars and buying yen. The trade imbalance would lower the exchange rate of the dollar and increase the exchange rate of the yen, thus increasing the cost of exports from Japan and increasing the cost of imports in the United States, which would eventually neutralize the trade imbalance. But they didn't do that. But because both China and Japan and several other Southeast Asia countries withheld their trade dollars from foreign exchange markets, their export prices and U.S. import prices were kept low. This caused an exacerbation of the U.S. trade deficit, and it also kept U.S. interest rates low since the bulk of those dollars were invested in U.S. bonds. Now, oil and metal prices declined precipitously during the late 1990s because of the rise in the U.S. dollar exchange rate. Declines in metal and oil prices were far less pronounced in many other currencies, and in fact, the gold price actually increased in some currencies, even while it was falling in U.S. dollars. So I began to realize during the late 1990s that the gold price, priced in U.S. dollars, would not sustain a rally until we saw the end of the rise in the dollar itself, that is, the exchange rate of the dollar. Between 1999 and 2001, the dollar rally petered out, and by 2002, the dollar was entrenched in a bear market as the combination of falling interest rates in the U.S. and the trade deficit took their toll. Oil, commodities, metals, and gold prices started rising. Now, let me pause here for a moment and let me make a comment. How is it that these guys, these economists, who are charting out these events and telling us this story, past tense, how come those guys aren't rich? Well, those guys ought to be making money hand over fist, shouldn't they? Do they follow their own advice? I don't know. I don't know how much money this guy Paul Van Eden's got. I don't know how much money he makes. But whether or not this guy follows his own advice, what's happening here is that's exactly what happened, past tense. Will this happen again, future tense? And the answer is, oh, yeah, it will. Because it's based upon a fundamental law of economics. I mean, it's just the way the world works. It's been this way for thousands of years, and people who take advantage of it, the people who are the super rich, the people who are the Donald Trumps and the Warren Buffetts and the Ted Turners, these are the people that take advantage of these trends in economics as they progress. I'm opposed to paper money. I think paper money sucks. It's the worst thing that could happen to us, fiat paper currency. But I profit from it. And when I do, I profit from it on the backs of some poor slob that lost his house. Does it make me feel bad? No. No, not at all. Because the poor slob that lost his house was going to lose his house anyway. Because he doesn't know history. He doesn't know about the Roman Empire. He doesn't know about the five causes of the collapse and fall of the Roman Empire. He went to public school. It was never brought up. He's not concerned with it. Anything outside of the Super Bowl and the ball games and the scores and the sports section on the news, he's just lost. He doesn't care about that. So he becomes a victim with every one of these waves in the economic cycles. People bought stocks. I didn't buy any stocks in the 1990s, and that's because stocks are a loser. You know, you've been told all of your life that over the long haul, the stock market continually rises. That's true. I don't deny it. But over the long haul, the people who buy stocks continually lose their money. The people who make money in stocks make their money as brokers off of the poor slobs that buy the stocks. Name one person that you know of who's made a lot of money in stocks or bonds. Tell me, name one. I'm an old man. I don't know of any. The people who make money consistently and continually in the stock market are the brokers and the professionals and the Wall Street bankers. They never lose. But all the Joe Sixpacks and all the people that put their money into 401ks and all these crazy investment and retirement schemes lose their shirts continuously over and over and over, and it never ceases. There's nothing you can do for Joe Sixpack. He's a continual loser. He's always been a loser. He'll always be a loser. And it's because he doesn't understand economics. He's never learned how to manage money. Warren Buffett has. Donald Trump has. And there are thousands of people like this Van Eden guy and the Mugambo and yours truly. I don't have any complaints about the Federal Reserve. I think it's a bad idea. I think the IRS is a bad idea. I think the income tax was a bad idea. But hey, you know, most Americans are in favor of the income tax, the IRS, Social Security, stocks and bonds, paper money, mortgages, debt, usury, interest. Most people out there are just as happy as clams at high tide with the status quo. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay, guys, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. I'll profit from it, but you're going to lose your shirt. You're going to lose your shirt practicing unjust weights and balances and practicing stocks and bonds and mortgages and usury and interest. And God told us that back at the tower at Mount Sinai, not the Tower of Babel, but Mount Sinai told us. Now, let me tell you economics. Economics comes from the Bible. Those that follow biblical economic principles prosper. I don't know of any exceptions to that. And people that don't practice those biblical economic principles don't prosper. But the thieves do. The lawyers do. And the investment bankers do. They make their money by selling you this worthless paper. They create it. And they get 100 cents value from it. And you get 3 cents value for it. Now you tell me that's a good deal. Hang on here and I'll give you a reminder and be back with more on economic meltdown when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order one, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily wholly endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about economic meltdown. I think most people out there in the real world are expecting it, waiting for it, dreading it, kind of like I am, but not knowing quite what to do about it. And so on this program, I'm trying to show you, here's what you do about it. You prepare for it just like you buy insurance and hope that it doesn't happen. But if it does happen, well, then okay, we profit from it. Now, when this economic meltdown comes, I intend to profit from it on the backs of the poor slob that lost his house. I feel sorry for you, Joe. And I hope you don't lose your house. I hope you own your house free and clear, and some opportunist like me doesn't come along and buy it for 50 cents on the dollar and hold it for the next upcycle. But, you know, history repeats itself, and housing markets are bubbles or become bubbles, and then prices go down. And when there are economic reversals, those of us are called sharks, swoop into the market, and we buy at the bottom, and then we hang on to that property until the market goes up, and then we sell it at a profit. I mean, that's the way the game is played. So let's see if we can't help you do the same thing. Now, the increase in most metals and commodity prices were initially just a reflection of the falling U.S. dollar exchange rate. However, because of the expansion occurring in China, among other things, some commodities and metals prices rose more than what could be accounted for by the dollar depreciation alone. The gold price, on the other hand, was almost exactly paired to the U.S. dollar exchange rate up to the middle of 2005. Now we can evaluate the current situation with the twin deficits of the United States. The United States trade deficit simply means that U.S. residents buy more imports than they export. The net result of the trade deficit is that U.S. dollars are being sent to other countries. And as mentioned earlier, under normal circumstances, those dollars would have been sold in foreign exchange markets, putting downward pressure on the dollar. A weaker dollar would translate into higher prices for U.S. imports and lower prices for U.S. exports, and that would in turn cause a reduction or elimination of the trade imbalance. Therefore, the U.S. trade deficit will eventually cause the U.S. dollar to decline. The only reason that it has not yet done so is because China, Japan, and several other countries are not selling their U.S. dollars, but rather they're investing them in U.S. treasuries instead. Now, that brings us to the U.S. fiscal deficit. A fiscal deficit arises when your government spends more than it receives from taxes. The U.S. fiscal deficit is much larger than the budget deficit, and contrary to what the media and the politicians would like you to believe, the U.S. fiscal condition is worsening. It is not getting better. The current debt limit for the U.S. government is $8 trillion, and if that limit is not raised by the middle of the month, the government will likely go into default. And all it means is that lawmakers will vote to increase the debt limit. They always have, and they always will. But the amount by which they will increase the debt limit is what is very interesting. The current proposal is for an increase of $781 billion. Why $781 billion? Why not a trillion or $2 trillion or some other number? Well, probably because that is more or less what they expect the fiscal deficit will be for the next 12 months or so. Now, can you grasp this? The number 781 billion. Now, your president comes out and he says the economy is growing 3.5% and everything's rosy and peachy cane. You're fighting two wars at the same time. And you've got this balance of payments deficit with the rest of the world, and then you've got this internal fiscal imbalance in the taxing and spending at the federal level. Leave out the states and your local city government and your county government, just your federal government, and they're expecting for the fiscal year 2006 a $780 billion deficit. That's a far cry, you know, from that $400 billion or $300 billion that they keep advertising. It's double or more. Now, boys and girls, that's going to have some very far-reaching economic consequences. It's kind of like you and your budget. You know, let's say you're making $10,000 a year and you're spending $11,000. And one day you decide that, well, our budget deficit is $1,000 this year. Why don't we just go ahead and make it $2,000? But instead of admitting that you're actually spending $2,000 more than you make, let's hide it. Let's take some money out of our savings account or out of our IRA or our Kroger or something like that and spend it on current bills and so on, and let's not count that. Well, okay, boys and girls, that's great for today, but later on when you go to retire, it's going to have a big impact on your retirement because the money isn't going to be there. And that's what Americans have been doing with their Social Security. They've been spending it every year. The surplus that you're putting into Social Security, you've already spent it. There was a surplus in 1986, 1992, 1999, 2005. There are going to be more surpluses until the year 2012. And you kept putting IOUs into your Social Security fund. Come on, boys and girls, it's time to wake up. You know, if you had a coffee can like I have here, see, we put our money into coffee cans here because we don't deal with banks. And various coffee cans have different budget monies in them. You know, you got to have a can here that's got your utility money in it so you can pay the electric bill and the telephone bill and so on. And you got to have some money here, you know, so you can pay your various and sundry expenses, you know, like food and clothing and shelter and so on. Well, let's suppose that you take your money out of your utility can and you spend that on your credit card debt because you spend a little extra for Christmas. Don't you think, you know, at the time you're spending it, everything's fine, but next month when it comes time to paying the electric bill, you don't have it. Well, they won't shut the electric off in the first month, but about the second month, or maybe the third month, you know, somebody's going to come out there and flip off your power. And that's going to affect your standard of living, and that's the moral of the story. You're not going to die from this fiscal mismanagement, but you're going to have a sudden change in your standard of living. Amish people live without electricity, but they're used to it, and they do it day in and day out. And so when the power goes off, the average Amish guy isn't going to notice that. But when your power goes off, Joe, you're going to notice it right away, especially if you've got electronic ignition on your gas stove. Now, during fiscal 2005, that ended on September the 30th, 2005, the government's debt increased by $554 billion. Since then, the debt has increased by $337 billion, which, when annualized, comes to $814 billion. So don't be misled by budget deficits. Politicians can budget all they like, but their spendthrift ways become evident in the increase in the debt. So if you want to know how much the deficit really is, take a look at how much they increase the debt limit. That tells you what the real budget deficit is. Now, as an aside, the current debt of $8 trillion does not include unfunded liabilities of the U.S. government, such as Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Including unfunded liabilities, the U.S. government is approximately $46 trillion in the hole. So you got $8 trillion out there that they dangle in front of your eyeballs. That's just the tip of the iceberg, boys and girls. In addition to that, there's $46 trillion on top of it. Now, you've been taking money, you know, Americans have been taking money out of their various coffee cans and then kidding themselves, you know, that everything is just honky-dory over here. So I come along and I say, no, I think you should listen to a couple other guys besides, you know, Bob Schieffer. He's a nice guy. Bob is a hell of a nice guy. Like, I watch him every night on the CBS Evening News. But he's not telling you everything that's going on. I don't know if it's because he doesn't know everything that's going on or because he probably knows, but he's not telling. But I think you need to know, and that's why I'm suggesting here in this series on economic meltdown, that you consider Kitco and start looking at some of these economic newsletters. USA Today is great. The Wall Street Journal is good. The New York Times is very entertaining. But there's reality out there, boys and girls, and I would suggest that you tune in to reality because it's going to affect you in the same way that it affected the Argentines and affected the Russians and has affected in past years the Brazilians and the Filipinos and the Chinese and the Japanese and everybody else. An economic collapse like 1929 is on the way. Now, my Aunt Bessie and your Aunt Bessie and all of the Aunt Bessies of the 1930s toughed it out, lived through it, and they told you these stories, didn't they, about how bad the Great Depression was. Don't you think it's time for you to take action so that it doesn't impact upon you the way it did Aunt Bessie? back in the 30s. Just a wild new concept. Prepare for it. Now, the fiscal deficit means that the U.S. government continually has to issue more and more debt to finance its spending, and the issuance of debt means an increase in the supply of U.S. bonds that will ultimately lead to lower bond prices and higher interest rates. This is where the trade deficit and the fiscal deficit meet. Just like the trade deficit implies the dollar will fall, the fiscal deficit will ultimately cause U.S. interest rates to rise. So you people out there who have these adjustable rate mortgages that you have been buying and speculating in real estate with, remember, these interest rates are going to rise. 1% this year is scheduled, and that's if nothing dramatic occurs. Have you got that budgeted in so that when your real estate mortgage, when your mortgage payments go up, are you going to be able to handle that? Are you prepared for it? Are you thinking about it? Now, recall that China, Japan, and others are buying U.S. Treasury debt and bonds with their trade dollars instead of selling those dollars into foreign exchange markets. And that is what has kept the dollar afloat so far. But it is also what kept U.S. medium to long-term interest rates so low, since no matter how much more debt the government issued, these nations stood ready to buy it. Now, looking at this, I realized that we are going to witness an unexpected turn of events. When China and Japan at some point decide to stop buying U.S. treasuries with their trade surplus dollars, which is inevitable at some point in time, the U.S. dollar exchange rate is going to fall simultaneously with rising U.S. interest rates. Now, this is not intuitive, since common dogma suggests currencies rise when interest rates rise and fall when interest rates fall. Yet I believe that the U.S. dollar is going to fall while U.S. interest rates are rising. And that's because there's this gigantic imbalance in the world's economy. Now, you probably already figured out how this works. When China and Japan stop buying U.S. treasuries with their trade dollars, they will no longer be supporting the U.S. government's debt issues, which means the U.S. fiscal deficit and the result necessary to issue these bonds will cause bond prices to fall and interest rates to rise. At the same time, China and Japan will have to do something with those dollars. And my suspicion is that they will gradually start selling more and more trade dollars for their own currencies so that they can invest in their own economies. So I'm not suggesting that China or Japan will start selling massive amounts of dollars that are currently being held in their foreign reserve accounts, merely that they will reduce the rate at which they are accumulating U.S. dollars in their foreign reserve accounts. Now, it's always been clear that China and Japan will support the U.S. dollar only as long as it is in their best interest, and I have made the point that it is in their interest only while U.S. consumption of their goods continues to grow. And we have seen that U.S. economic growth is faltering, and therefore I believe we're at the end of their support of the dollar. Now, in December, a Chinese newspaper called The Standard printed an article that quoted Mr. Yu Yongding, a member of the Monetary Policy Advisory Committee to the People's Bank of China, as saying that China should weaken the link between the yuan and the U.S. dollar to make the exchange rate more flexible and improve the Chinese government's ability to manage their economy. Yu suggested that the weighting of the U.S. dollar in the basket of currencies against which the yuan is set should be reduced, thereby reducing the impact that changes in the U.S. dollar would have on the value of the yuan. So let's pause here for a moment and let's digest this. The Chinese have a bunch of money that they have saved, money that they have reinvested in U.S. bonds. Now, as the U.S. consumer begins to buy fewer Chinese tennis shoes and big screen TVs, just like as your boss, your company, starts to cut back on the number of hours that you work, you in turn have to cut back on the amount of money that you spend. As your income decreases, you have to decrease your spending. And that's all the Chinese are going to do. And if that occurs, then they're going to have to take their reserves, that is their savings, and spend their savings. And that's normal. If you got cut back 2 days a week, you might have to dip into your savings. Now, as long as there is overtime and as long as you're working full time, you're going to be spending your money full time. But you know, all that comes to an end. There are cycles that go on, and as these cycles move and change, which is where we're at today, there's a cycle here that's moving and changing, and as this cycle changes, there's going to be a hell of a impact on the world's economy, because America is the biggest consumer nation in the world. 20% of the world's economy is represented by the U.S. economy. 20%. We only represent about 3 or 4% of the world's population, or 5%, something like that, but 20% of the world's economy. Now, when we cut back, the rest of the world is going to catch pneumonia. When we Americans catch cold, the rest of the world gets pneumonia, and that's what's coming up. Now, if you're prepared for it, there's a lot of money to be made. If you're not prepared for it, there's a lot of money to be lost. And it's just that simple. So if you're in a an employment where you are at risk of losing your job, you can just about bet on it. You should be preparing for job loss or massive cutbacks or just a little bit of cutback. And then you should start budgeting for that. If you've got one of these adjustable rate mortgages and you got a second house someplace and you're driving truck for some sand and gravel company, which is heavily engaged in construction, and construction is going to be cut back and your income is going to be cut back, maybe even eliminated, and you're going unemployment insurance, are you going to be able to make that mortgage payment on that second home? Are you going to be able to make your bills? Are you going to be able to pay your credit card debts? That's the bottom line. And if the answer to that is no, then you need to make some massive adjustments right away, real quick, in a big hurry. That's all. And if you don't, it's no big deal. Your creditors will come take all your toys away from you, and you can start over at zero COD again. How's that? Or you can prepare for it, and in many cases, you can actually prosper from it. That's why I teach a business school, and in our business school, we teach, here's how to make money. This is actually an economic school. It's a little different than public school. Here's how you manage money. Here's the way you make money. Just like Warren Buffett or Donald Trump. Now, I'm not a Warren Buffett. I'm never going to be a billionaire, I don't think. But I'm not poor. I'm able to pay my bills, and I'm able to get by. And when these downturns in the economy come along, it impacts upon me. It just doesn't impact upon me to the point where I'm going to lose my home or my car, or I'm going to suffer. I'm going to have to be eating spaghetti and macaroni because I can't afford meat and potatoes. And I think everybody could be in the same boat. Everybody needs to prepare. It's kind of like old Joseph preparing for the great famine back in the Egyptian times. If you're prepared, it's no big deal. If you're not prepared, it can be a big deal. Hey, we're about out of time. We'll finish this up next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review, tomorrow night. Now, let me give you a final reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll finish this up next time on the Law Hour. So until then, we'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks for listening, and good night, friends.